you know, it's been a little while, at least for us, since we did this. Was there anything from the previous three chapters that you were unclear on? Anything you remember?
Not really.
Today on Quantum Paradoxes, we discuss two outstanding interference paradoxes by Aharonov that introduce the Aharonov boom effect. In the process of exploring these paradoxes, we're going to talk about the electrostatics of an infinite sheet of charge, vector potentials and gauge fields, flux quantization and magnetoresistance, and complex matrix algebra. All of this is coming up right now when Randy and Jim discuss Yakir Aharonov and Daniel Rorlick's Quantum Paradoxes, Chapter 4, Phases and Gauges. Yakir Aharonov and Daniel Rorlick's Quantum Paradoxes, Chapter 4, Phases and Gauges.
I do remember the last chapter was especially difficult because of the statistical mathematics involved in proving entanglement. But I think we covered that pretty well.
Okay, so we got through entanglement, and now we're in this phases and gauges deal. In this chapter, he has two related paradoxes.
Yeah, it's really two. It's one paradox in two different forms, right?
Very much so. Basically, he's used two different setups. One of them is very similar to the earlier paradoxes.
The one of the, yeah, like the...
The one with the moving partition in the center.
Right.
Where you're trying to
the
measure...
influence of a passing electron through one of the double slit experiment.
That's right.
Setups.
And these are double slit experiments in this.
That's right. In fact, I like the way this chapter opens up because they make a very clear distinction. They frame the argument and they say that Einstein was claiming that if you could find a way to measure which one of the two slits an electron passes through, that the interference pattern would still exist. Because he's got a very classical interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bohm said, and he actually showed, that if you can measure which slit it goes through, then the interference pattern disappears.
I'm not sure that Einstein was saying this isn't what quantum mechanics said. He may have been a little bit unclear about that, but I think he was saying that this is one of the problems with quantum mechanics, right? I mean, you have to wait until you get to a more advanced stage, right, than, you know, 1920 or whenever they're having these arguments, experimentally to actually show that the quantum mechanical predictions are correct.
Mm-hmm.
That if you measure what's going on through one of these slits, you break down the wave function. I guess the interesting thing in all of these arguments that Bohr made was that through each one of these arguments, he showed physically, step by step, how to get there, rather than just having it sort of be a postulate and be told that this is what's going to happen. He went through and physically analyzed the experiment.
Reasoned it out.
Yeah, and looked at what happens to the sliding partition with the two slits in it and says, well, yeah, if it goes through this slit so that it pushes down over here, that not only gives you a delta X, that gives you a delta P, and therefore you end up with the uncertainty principle yet again in a lot more detail than that.
It's very much like a Greek debate, isn't it? You know, the Greeks had a series of a priori assumptions, and then they would have logical arguments about what the outcome of various situations would be. And in this case, it's pretty uncanny to see such finely tuned arguments in physics being battled out by two giants of physics, you know. And Bohm coming up with the right answers, even when it seemed totally contrary to reason that answer existed, until he took a really, really hard look at it and found solutions, like in the clock in the box paradox.
These were all very, very difficult problems, and they don't really make sense. I mean, at this point, I think most people accept them because they've been shown to be the way things are. You know, they don't make any sense whatsoever. I mean, you start thinking about things like, I have this particle, right? And you say things like, we know the electron is point-like at least at 10 to the minus 22 meters, right? In one sense, we say that. But in the other sense, we say, but we don't have any idea where it is. It could be anywhere in this one angstrom area with such and such a probability for being in this little region over here. You've got these quantum mechanical particles that in one sense are very, very small and should have a very defined position, but don't. It's just very difficult to come to grips with that. In some sense, that's still a little bit of a cop-out, right? We don't have a really well-defined position of it. On the other hand, that's more or less what you can say, at least with the mathematics available to us at this point.
Yeah, I find my mind constantly revolting against this stuff. My intuitive reasoning is constantly at war with these concepts. And I think that the main reason is that there isn't a rational or readily comprehensible visual model for explaining why is it like this. You know, it's easy enough to, you could sort of forestall the sort of intellectual revulsion by saying that the math describes it this way, but there's that, but then giving yourself the possibility that there's a more classical interpretation which will make that math make sense to you, instead of saying, okay, it's a wave function. Well, how do you visualize a wave function? And how does it reach so far beyond this point-like particle? How can it be a point-like particle if it has a wave function which extends out so many angstroms, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, what I found kind of confusing about this whole procedure in this chapter is that the models that they're talking about, in this case it was the parallel plate capacitor set between the two slits, so that if an electron goes through one side, it interacts with the positive charged plate and attracts it, and it goes through the other slit and it interacts with the negatively charged plate and it repels it. I have a problem with that, by the way, is that in either case, the parallel plate capacitor moves in the same direction, so how do you know which one it goes through? Okay. I think they got a spring between the plates, and I guess they're saying that if one plate gets pushed, you're going to know which side is getting pushed.
Yes. Let me describe this in a little more detail, and remember that question. We'll get to that, you know, if anybody's listening.
Right. If there's anybody out there.
So this first paradox was basically one where you have a double slit experiment, right? And you have your source, and then you get to your double slit, and at the very end, you end up with a screen. That's your basic double slit experiment. The screen has an interference pattern on it. In the shadow of that...
Behind the center barrier.
Yeah, behind the center barrier, you have that capacitor with a spring in it. This capacitor is charged, positive plate one side, negative plate the other side. And since it's in that shadow, as far as the wave functions are concerned, there's no chance for the electron to feel anything that's going on in that parallel plate capacitor. You know, Aharonov, he takes a little bit of time to say things like, well, we only turn it on after it's gone through the slit and before it gets to the end so it doesn't feel any fringing fields, things like that.
Right.
Which are sort of important for the interpretation and would be impossible basically to do in a real situation, but that's perfectly fine if you've got a thought experiment. If somebody's listening doesn't know much about parallel plate capacitors, they're basically what you see in all physics one sort of, or physics two sort of classes. You know, you have one plate completely charged, the other plate completely charged. You pretend they go out to infinity, and they're parallel to each other, these two plates. They go out to infinity.
Like a sandwich.
Like a, yeah, an infinite sandwich of an electric field. And between these two plates, you end up with an electric field that is uniform. That's their most important thing. The second thing is outside of the plates, the fields cancel, so that there's no electric field outside of the plates, and in between the plates, there is a field.
I've always been a little bit bewildered about that, but maybe we should talk about that some other time. Like, if you're at a point just outside of a positively charged plate, isn't the positive field density going to be much higher than the negative field density from the other plate? So how could they cancel?
This has to do with the assumption that it's infinite in size. So because it's infinite in size and it's flat, and this is something that makes the flat earthers happy, if you have just one plate and it's positive, it will have an electric field pointing out that's uniform throughout all of space. And on one side, it'll go one direction. On the other side, it'll go the other direction. But on either one of those two half spaces, the field is uniform and it goes out to infinity. It all has the same...
Wait, if you have one plate, isn't the field going to drop off by the inverse square?
From each point, it drops off as an inverse square. From each little tiny charge on the plate, little tiny infinitesimal piece of charge density.
Oh, but when you sum it?
But when you sum it, it becomes uniform.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you take that integral, you do the math, or actually what you usually do is you use Gauss's law to find it. But you can do the integral. It is a possible integral to do, in case you doubt Gauss's law, like my students do. So I make.
So an infinitely charged plate could put a uniform electrical field through the entire universe.
Yeah, you just need an infinite, I guess it's an infinite charge, but it has a finite charge density, infinite in extent. As long as the universe is infinite and your plate is infinite, everything works out. The same, and since the mathematics for this is the same as for gravity, that's why I said it makes the flat earthers happy, because you end up with a uniform gravitational field. If you do the same thing, which looks a lot like, you know, this g equals minus 9.8 meters per second squared sort of thing that you start out with in physics. It's just that it doesn't really, really work that way. It's just very close to the surface of the Earth. It looks like that. But for this flat world, it doesn't matter how high up you get. You have the same acceleration due to gravity.
Wow, that's really weird. Okay.
Yeah, well, it is weird, and it couldn't possibly be true, because you'd have an infinite amount of energy in the universe to make it happen, but it's kind
of
cool.
Yeah, that's one of those nice mathematical tricks. Okay, cool. All right, so you're talking about the plates.
Yeah, so we have a capacitor behind there. There's no field outside, so the electrons go by, and they don't feel a net force from the plates.
Right, because there's no electrical field for them to interact with on the outside of the
capacitor. Yeah, there's no net electric field for them to interact with. It's no net electric field. So there are two electric fields that it does interact with, one from the positive plate, one from the negative plate. So if I were to say the electron is going through the top slit, let's do everything vertically. So we've got a top slit, positive plate, negative plate, bottom slit, right? So if the electron goes through the top slit, the positive plate, which is near to it, gets pulled up by the electron, and the electron gets pulled down with the same force. The negative plate gets pushed down, and the electron gets pushed up with the same force. Now, since these two plates have equal and opposite charges, they have equal and opposite forces on the electron, so the net effect on the electron is null, all right? But the positive plate still got pulled up, the negative plate still got pushed down, and so they have a larger separation.
Right.
And then the electron goes its own way, and you record, you know, when the electron went by, these two guys got farther away, the capacitance changed, maybe you have a capacitance meter on there somewhere, and the world is good, you figured out that the electron went through the hole.
This is Einstein's paradoxical challenge to the model, right? He's saying that this is what would happen.
I don't remember if this is Einstein or this is just Aharonov's explanation, using the same sort of paradox so that he can build up to the quantum flux.
Yeah, I was wondering when this paradox was first proposed, because I noticed that Aharonov and Bohm didn't publish their explanation until 1959.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed really late in the game for such a simple paradox to have been solved. I would have thought that Bohm or somebody would have looked at this decades earlier during the main debate on the subject.
Yeah, well, for this particular one, I don't think they were worried about it. And I think the main reason for the capacitor paradox is because of the cylinder paradox we're going to get to next.
Okay.
And I think that the capacitor paradox is just a slightly simpler way of looking at the same paradox that doesn't end up involving modular variables.
Yeah, and I like the way that it frames their response to it. What do they call it? The Aharonov-Bohm effect. Because it lines it up almost like mathematical terms.
Yeah.
Here's your energy field. Mm-hmm. You know, here's your vectors.
Okay. And I think your original question was, what about if it goes down negative, wouldn't it do the same thing? Was that what your question was? If the electron goes down through the bottom now. So you had some question before I started explaining this.
Yeah.
You had some question saying...
Oh, I was thinking about the capacitor as more of like a fixed body.
Okay.
Because if the capacitor is like a solid state dielectric style capacitor, then if the electron goes through the slit on the positive side, it's going to attract it, and if the electron goes through the slit on the negative side, it's going to push it, and so the net effect of moving the force on the capacitor is going to be the same. So how would you know which one it went through anyway? But you're talking about mobile plates, you know, and the way that you framed it makes a lot more sense.
Okay. I guess we should say if it goes to the negative side or the bottom side, then the negative plate, which is closer, gets pushed up and the positive plate gets pulled down and
they get closer together.
It gets smaller. Yeah, they get closer together.
That increases the capacitance, right? Or does that decrease it?
That increases the capacitance. Smaller distance between the plates increases the capacitance.
Right. So just with a meter, you'd know which one of these two slits it went through.
That's right.
Cool.
So anyways, I don't have any other notes on this, so there doesn't seem to be anything. The cylinder is a little weirder. So the cylinder has in that same shadow. So if you imagine light passing between two slits.
Electrons, I think was the...
Well, he's using electrons. I don't think I gave the analogy well enough, but I think we've all seen light coming through a keyhole or something, and it's spreading out in that sort of cone shape. And that's what happens in the slits.
Right.
I know you see that. You see the picture in the book and all that other stuff, and you're familiar with these kinds of experiments, but I don't know about other people who might be listening. In the cylinder problem, you have the same thing, only you have a charged cylinder. So you have a capacitor that's a cylinder instead.
Right.
And the center of the cylinder is a charged wire, and then there's like air or some other dielectric in the middle, probably air, because this cylinder that's containing that charged wire has an equal and opposite total charge. That is free to rotate. And so that's what's sitting now between these two slits.
Right, and the wire and the cylinder are running the same along the same axis as the slits, mm-hmm. vertically. And so, or the change in angular speed, is it? I think is the idea.
What's going to happen is when an electron passes by, there's going to be a...
clockwise spin in one direction, if it goes through one slit.
It'll be a clockwise spin in one direction. So it'll start spinning clockwise in one direction as the electron approaches, and then as the electron goes away, there'll be a torque in the opposite direction, and when the electron gets infinitely far away, or far enough away, it'll have been an equal amount of torque as when it came in as when it left, so it'll have stopped. So it'll move a little bit to the left, or a little bit to the clockwise direction in one sense, and anti-clockwise, counterclockwise, Wittershins, whatever your favorite term is, in the other direction.
Wittershins, yeah, of course, that's always my favorite term. Okay. All right, let's move on to the next point here. So in that case, then the next section gets into the difference between classical and quantum phases.
In both of these cases, we've said somehow that we're able to look at this
experimental setup and know which and know slit
when it came through, which means we found some problem with quantum mechanics. And in the long run, I'm sure everybody's reasonably sure that we're going to say that's not true.
I think the point was that if we can tell which slit that it goes through, mm-hmm. then it should destroy the interference pattern.
Well, if we can, there should be some effect that destroys the interference pattern. But right now, all we have is some way that shouldn't affect the electron to determine which slit the electron's gone through.
Right, so we know something's amiss because everybody knows you can't do that.
And then he starts talking about phases. I don't think we immediately get to the interesting thing about the phase. All a phase is basically the relative time when a oscillation starts. Right.
That was a strange point that they make in the next chapter that I really was not aware of, that in quantum mechanics, that phase is always relative, that there is no absolute phase. I had no idea.
Well, there's no way to measure an absolute phase, because we always measure the intensity, I think, rather than the amplitude. And the phase is part of the amplitude. So we can measure the equivalent of beat patterns, but we can't really tell where any particular wave started.
Yeah, and that's strange because all of the classical waves that we know have a clear shape that you can distinguish in space and time, that's a trough, that's a peak.
With those waves, there's a physical meaning to the amplitude.
Right.
I say, okay, I've got my water wave. Well, it's just the height of the wave.
Right.
I've got my sound wave. It's
just the density of the air.
Exactly. And so forth and so on. Whereas for the quantum mechanical wave, the amplitude is this probability amplitude. And we can't measure that probability amplitude independently of making an intensity measurement on that. And that's what he's saying, is that we can only measure the relative phase.
And that's where we get into the gauge deal, right? Because when you're measuring differences on a gauge, it's the differences that you see that are relevant as opposed to an absolute value. Is that where it gets into the gauge theory part of this?
Well, I think the gauge shows up because it induces phases in both of these cases. So that's what I got off of this, you know, third reading of this chapter, is that the gauge, which is not a real gauge, it's a function, is going to change the phase in one of these electron if it goes through one slit rather than the other.
Okay.
The way these gauges work is fairly technical. In a junior level, senior level electromagnetism course, you may barely kind of touch on gauge invariance. And what I recall from graduate school is that for gauge invariance, you get a very, very brief introduction to it. And you're sent off to solve some horribly complex problems that simplify if you can just figure out what the right gauge is. And that's what mainly it was for. And they have different gauges. I think I should have looked this up. I was looking at Jackson earlier today, and I didn't bother with this. But, you know, there's Lorentz gauge and some other gauges that are fairly famous because they solve particular problems or they represent a particular situation.
Yeah, at the end they talk about how the matrices in the gauge theories explain the nuclear strong force and the electroweak force.
That's the
non-Abelian
gauge theory. That's getting even weirder. Okay. So right now we're just dealing with plain old vectors and scalars.
Right.
We're saying, okay, each object, it has one wave function, and it's just a single function, and it's just these probability amplitudes. As it propagates using a Hamiltonian. And a Hamiltonian is a fancy way of saying a differential for the energy, right? has a kinetic energy part, has a potential energy part, and the electric and magnetic fields don't actually go into that very well, which is the reason why we have to use, rather than electric fields and magnetic fields, we use a vector potential plus the scalar potential. The scalar potential is the thing that it looks a lot like the thing that you measure the potential difference of in a circuit. So if you measure V in a circuit, the voltage, it's similar to that. That's the way you teach it. Vector potential is related to that, but it's weird and strange. Well, I shouldn't say it's weird and strange, but it's a vector, and I have no idea how anybody measures it. So I know how you can measure delta V. I don't know how you can measure delta A.
Yeah, I think they actually talk about the fact that you can't measure it directly, that you have to basically infer it.
Something like that. And it turns out that these potentials, usually don't think of them as the real thing. You usually think of the electric and magnetic fields that are the actual forces, or sort of the force densities pushing things around. You think of those as being the real thing. But in quantum mechanics, you can't use those, so you use these vector and scalar potentials. The vector potential modifies the momentum a little bit, and the scalar potential basically acts as a potential energy.
That is a startling point that I found in reading that. It was like, I always thought that you could describe like an electromagnetic wave as simply an electrical and a magnetic component. But here he's talking about, no, that's not a complete picture. And he goes on to prove why it's not a complete picture. But I thought you could describe it with those two factors. But no, you need these vector potential.
I think classically, you don't need them.
Classically, but that's the incomplete description of reality, right?
I mean, you do need them if you want to use Hamiltonian mechanics. And Hamiltonian mechanics is classical. And the thing about quantum mechanics is the Schrodinger equation is a Hamiltonian, or it's a Hamiltonian equation. You know, since the Schrodinger equation is a Hamiltonian, you have to use these. Fine and dandy. The place where it actually becomes important, right, is that the gauge means something, and if it can have physical effect on something, which it cannot classically, then this vector and scalar potential, they have to be real entities.
Right.
Right. The whole point of that is the electric and magnetic fields are really just derivatives of these vector and scalar. Because they're derivatives, there are other kinds of derivatives that cannot be...
classically explained?
Cannot be observed in the electric and magnetic fields themselves.
Right, so you can get the electrical and magnetic field out of the vector and scalar potentials, but you can't do it the other way around.
That's right. You can't get a unique scalar or vector potential. You get a vector or scalar potential, or vector and scalar potential, to within this gauge function, lambda. And this gauge function, the gradient, sort of the three-dimensional slope of this gauge function, adds into the vector potential. Time derivative of this gauge function adds into the scalar potential. And the way these electric and magnetic fields are constructed mathematically, because you've constructed this gauge function this way, just mathematically that disappears. So basically, up to this point, up to this lambda, you can find this VNA, but there are multiple potentials that work with the same field. So let's see, I mean, I think the way you might think about this is, if you think of the height of a bowl, you can get a bowl shape, but you can describe the position from the top of your table, from your floor, from your ceiling. You can describe the position from any reference point. And in a lot of ways, that gauge function is like a reference point, or at least it is like a reference point as long as you don't believe that it's a real thing. As soon as you believe that it's a real thing, as soon as it gives you physical effects, then it's not just a reference point.
Right. And that's what the whole Aharonov and Bohm effect is about, right?
That's right. It's saying, okay, well, because A and V are directly inside of the Hamiltonian, changes to A and V by choosing these gauge functions can change the wave function of a particle, and in certain situations.
So let's talk about that. Let's get to the interesting part where we get the solution to our paradox.
Let's start with the capacitor problem.
Right.
So the capacitor problem, you have no field on the outside and a uniform field on the inside of this capacitor. And you're perfectly free to choose your potential to be zero any place that you want to.
Right.
Say at this spot, it's zero. Everything has to be consistent after you've chosen that.
Relative to that point.
Relative to that point. But you can just say that at this point, my potential is zero. And so you say, okay, on this top slit, I'm going to say my potential is zero. The way you'd find out what the potential is at the other slit is to do a line integral over the field. Basically, you add up a little bit of distance times a little bit of field all the way down to get there.
Right.
Right. Which means that since there's zero, then there's this place where there's a uniform field. Just you end up adding the same amount for every little increment along the...
Because it's a uniform density of energy in there?
Yeah. Just add the same amount all the way through. Mm-hmm. And then you don't add anything on the other side. So on one side of the plate, you have a flat potential. On the other side of the plate, you have a flat potential. On the top, it's at zero. At the bottom, it's the strength of the electric field times the width of the capacitor. Okay. That's more or less the difference there. What happens is that change in the potential induces a phase difference in a wave packet, if it goes one direction or if it goes the other. Okay. And in fact, what they've done is they've said, okay, let's pretend that, you know, even though you have this electron that could go through either one of these slits, it has this probability amplitude, and it splits into two bits. Mm-hmm. Right. So it has a probability to go up. It has a probability to go down. We don't know what it is, but this amplitude is evolving according to the Schrodinger equation. Then it hits this place. If it goes through the top slit, because that's where V is zero, basically nothing happens to it. If it goes through the bottom slit, it hits this change in potential, which is like hitting a change in the energy, like hitting an energy barrier. That ends up giving it a phase shift. And that phase shift ends up being proportional to the gauge difference between the two different spots.
And if I read this correctly, the weird part here is that somehow that electron, even though it's not passing through an energy density change physically, mm-hmm. because the energy is all contained within the capacitor, yeah. somehow the fact that energy is there affects it at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird. It reminds me kind of like, the first thing I thought of was gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, here it's like the space-time in that region has been distorted somehow by the presence of the energy. It's like if you're changing the background, you know?
Well, what they actually do mathematically is they solve the top thing with the top bit V equals zero. Then they solve the bottom thing with the bottom bit with V equals zero, but that bottom bit with a V equals zero with the gauge transformation between these two things. So that gauge transformation is actually shifting the level. But yeah, I mean, it is this really strange thing where you end up with these two different levels like that. And somehow the ladder goes up over on this side to that side, and it has to meet in the end.
Well, that's what the other thing that I wanted to get to is, what's the effect of this on the interference pattern on the screen?
This produces the interference pattern on the screen.
Wait, so when we have the capacitor between
them? Well, actually, it should not produce the interference pattern on the screen. But this would produce interference itself. So this itself produces interference. I think that's the point, is that if you try to detect this, right, you're going to produce a different interference pattern.
Right. As I recall from the chapter, it said that the interference pattern shifts by one wavelength.
Yeah.
So it sounds, I think he even said that it's not measurable.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the interference pattern has shifted by one bar, basically, of your mm-hmm. interference pattern.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess there is some way that they experimentally have verified that this is what happens.
I think what happens is that the shift is proportional to the momentum of the wave or of the electron, and the change in the distance of the capacitor plates has its own change. And those things multiplied together get washed out with the uncertainty principle. So your measurement is proportional to the momentum, your difference in potential is proportional to the size of change in the separation. And so you end up with that screwing you up. You end up inducing a PY, an uncertainty in the momentum, the vertical momentum, and that gets rid of your interference pattern. I think you still end up getting rid of the interference pattern. That's what I recall. And I think you do that in the next section, in the consistency check section, in section 4.5.
So let me get this right. If you have your double slit experiment without the capacitor between there, it's going to look the same as it will when you put the capacitor in there, behind in that shadow, or is the interference pattern, the entire interference pattern, going to disappear?
I think the entire interference pattern disappears.
Okay, that's what I originally thought, but started getting unsure of that.
Yeah, as you try to improve how accurate your separation knowledge is and how accurate your, or how defined your interference pattern is, if you try to improve those, it destroys your interference.
That's really strange. I've never seen that yet online. I've looked at a lot of double slit experiment stuff, and I've never seen one where they say they show you the double slit experiment, and then they show you that you can just put a capacitor between those two plate, between the two slits, and suddenly you don't have an interference.
Maybe I didn't say this well enough previous. One, you have to be in some situation where you can measure this this capacitor. So if this capacitor is a real capacitor,
right,
and
parallel plate, and it's connected to a capacitance meter,
yeah, and it's not doing any weird things, then it's not going to do anything. But actually, if it's a real capacitor, it will do something, and that something is it will interfere with the electron's path, because a real capacitor would have fringing fields, because it would have to be small to stay within that shadow.
Oh, right. You'd have to have it timed, like they say in the setup.
Yeah, you have to have this thing timed, and you have to have some, maybe you can do it with, you know, one of these femtosecond rise time function generators, but I doubt it, because you have to time the electron, and you have to hit it right at the exact time.
Right. You need to know the electron's in the center, passing the center of the plate at exactly when your amplitude's at maximum, then drop to zero by the time it reaches the end.
That's right. Yeah, so I don't think they can physically perform this experiment.
Okay, but if they could, it would destroy the interference pattern entirely.
That's what Section 4.5 is going to say. Section 4.4 is getting to the Aharonov-Bohm effect and is trying to explain the relationship between the phase and the gauge.
Okay.
And it's really, really straightforward for this first experiment. I don't remember if it is for the second experiment. It's a little more interesting for the second experiment. But for that first experiment, it's really, really straightforward. Phase is proportional to the gauge function. And that gauge function, they figure out in a very similar way to what I was talking about with figuring out the difference in potential. Only now they're integrating over the potential, and they're integrating that in time.
Okay.
But beyond that, it's fairly simple.
Did they model on how does the gauge function know that the energy is between those plates? Is there any? Because that's why I was saying that it's kind of, it reminded me of gravity. It's like,
well, the potential is the thing that knows that. There has to be a change in energy between those plates.
Right.
For there to be a field.
Right.
So if there's no field gradient, if you have zero field, then there's no change in the potential. So if there's no change in the potential, there's a zero field. So anywhere where there's a zero field, like outside of these plates,
right,
there's nothing going on, but there is a step up. Part of that is to actually get that uniform field. We're assuming we have an infinitely sized parallel plate capacitor.
Or this incredibly well-timed situation that we talked about before where the fringing becomes irrelevant.
Just for the potential, the way it's done, the way they put it together, you want to have that infinitely sized parallel plate. Otherwise, you know, you have some other connection. There should be some connection via the field around in some strange circuitous path. That makes a little bit more sense, right? Because you're looking at how the field is moving out from the physical capacitor with those fringing fields.
Right.
How that moves out is how the potential is increasing. So the potential is like the electric potential energy.
Right.
So it's like any other potential energy. You climb up a hill, you increase that potential energy, right?
Right.
On either side of this capacitor, it's like you've climbed up a hill. One side is low, one side is high.
Yep. Yeah, but the question is, how does the position at the top of the hill on either side of that capacitor know that it's at a different height than the center if it doesn't have an interaction with it? Because there's no physical force interaction. How does that electron know, hey, right over there, there's this potential energy bound between two plates?
The electron is not supposed to know. Classically, the electron does not know.
Right.
It's only quantum mechanically that this shows up.
Right. But it's real. They've detected that this is real, right?
Well, I mean, you have the Aharonov-Bohm effect in real situations.
Right.
So it's a real thing. So how does that electron know? I don't know. Now, the fields are real things, right? The fields aren't just shorthand. At one point, we thought fields were just shorthand for forces.
Right.
But, you know, the fields actually have energy in them. This energy is real. It's come from somewhere, and it's dispersed in such a way that you end up with this potential energy configuration. And the gauge function itself is a field of space and time. Otherwise, you couldn't take those derivatives I was talking about.
Right.
So since the gauge function is a field, it must in some way have something to do with the energy. Well, we know it has something to do with the energy because it modifies the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian's all about finding the energy. So there's some energy associated with that gauge field that's sort of hidden from us classically.
And the electron feels that? Because why? The electron's not really located entirely in the position that it is because it has gauge field extending beyond it?
Well, it feels that in whatever way that probability amplitudes get modified. So it's the probability amplitudes that react to this
So
gauge.
Those must somehow reach outside of the electron to into the capacitor to intersect with it somehow, so you get an interaction, right? Okay. Because that's the old non-local part that I'm struggling with. I'm like, wait a minute.
It has to have some sort of non-local rationale for that.
So could that vector potential field, maybe this is what it is when we were saying before that the that there's an electrical and a magnetic classical component to the electrons charge and movement, but it's not a complete explanation because the quantum mechanics adds the gauge function. Maybe there's an aspect to the charge distribution around an electron, which we know drops off by the inverse square and extends out to infinity. Maybe there's like a hidden quality to that field that's this probability distribution that you're talking about that interacts with the conditions inside the capacitor.
Possibly. I bet a particle theorist has something to say about that. I have no idea. But I think the gauge field is important in particle theory, and it has some meaning.
Right, and that's how they came up with these. Later on, we'll get into the models for electroweak and nuclear strong force.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. It's kind of a headbender. So much for our classic physics. Even a simple thing like an electron suddenly is doing weird things that aren't explained by electrical potentials. Like, well, wait, I thought the only thing that affects an electron is electrical potentials. No, there's this other probability field that's non-physical mathematically.
Lots of things affect electrons.
Okay.
That's not really true.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Here's another question. If you do this experiment with the capacitor between the two slits and you run a photon through there, is it going to affect the photon or is it only going to be the electron? Like, is there an equivalent paradox for the photon? Or... I mean, if it's a Hamiltonian deal.
The photon should not couple to these things, I don't think.
But that's the thing. Is it the potential inside the capacitor?
I think
an energy
the photon
deal?
Is the gauge boson itself. And the photon doesn't interact with the other gauge boson.
Right, because photons don't interact with each other?
Yeah, and I'm going to bet at a fundamental level this gauge function is related to just photons and Ws and Zs and gluons and stuff like that.
Okay.
I'm going to bet that. I don't know. I bet somebody listening to this will tell us all about it.
I'd like to hear that, actually.
Yeah, I guess we said something similar happens with the cylinder situation. In that case, the interesting thing is, well, I have 2 pi n here. So basically, it keeps on going around and around in a circle.
Wait, I thought when we first talked about this experiment that if the electron went through one slit, it would go clockwise, and then you said it would correct itself and go counterclockwise after it passed.
Yeah.
And then in the other slit, it would go counterclockwise and then clockwise once it had passed.
Well, no, I mean...
Or are you talking about...
So the torque does, not...
The torque, not the actual rotation.
So the torque is...
So yes.
The torque is related to the angular acceleration. So
right.
The electron goes by, it...
Rotates,
it starts,
and then it slows
It starts
down.
The thing rotating until it gets to the medial point. And then it goes by,
and
then it slows it down. And by symmetry, it has to be slow it down exactly how much it sped up by, and it stops afterwards at some rotation.
Okay. When they
and that's what you're supposed to be able to detect.
Okay.
That was a little weird trying to figure that out. You know, they say it nice and clearly after you figure it out. You say, oh yeah, that's exactly what they were saying the whole time.
It's always nice when this stuff makes sense on the rare occasions that I find that it does. All right, so the next section here was flux quantization.
For the consistency, both of these things, you ended up destroying the interference pattern. Yeah, measuring phi erases the interference pattern. Measuring the amount that this thing is moved around destroys the interference pattern, basically because you have the angular momentum producing part of this. The angular momentum of the electron is producing this effect.
Well, okay, here's a academic concept. If you're not measuring it, if you just have that charged cylinder behind that shadow area, mm-hmm. it's still going to destroy the interference pattern, right? You don't have to look at it, do you? It's going to spin whether you're looking or not, right?
Yeah, I'm going to say that it has spun, so it will destroy the interference pattern.
All right, because there's so much spookiness about this whole observer changing the experiment and all that, and I just, you know, want to be absolutely clear about that. That you don't have to actually take the measurement and look for this to destroy the interference pattern.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's true.
All right, good, because that my worldview likes that.
Okay. Yeah, and it has to be that way, because otherwise you could look at the interference pattern and then go and look at whether the thing moved a little bit later.
But if you never look, it still destroyed the interference pattern, right? Because you could actually measure the interference pattern. So,
you know, you have an electron that's gone by the cylinder, right? It's a charged object going by this charged cylinder.
It's going to turn it or not.
And if it's going to turn it, it'll turn it or
it's
it will not.
That way.
Yeah, it'll have to do it. It has no choice, as far as I'm concerned. Something has to happen. Because something went by. I have my electron gun. I'm making these electrons. I make one go by this way and zap. Something has to happen to my charged cylinder.
This is my whole problem with the Schrodinger's cat thing, is that, you know, just because you didn't look doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
That's the whole reason why Schrodinger invented his cat. Just because you didn't look doesn't mean it didn't happen. That was his point.
Right, but they claim that he was proven wrong, don't they? Doesn't the Copenhagen interpretation say, oh no, the cat's in a superimposed state? It just sounds wrong to me.
Yeah,
but they're teaching that every day in school right now, aren't they? The cat's in alive and dead state until you look. That really annoys me.
Not completely sure about that. I do remember the Schrodinger cat, but I remember it being one of these things where it's supposed to be a brain teaser for you to completely not understand what's going on, right? I mean, it's important to not understand what's going on at that in that context, because you know, you have to figure out what this collapse of the wave function actually means. And in our case, the collapse of the wave function means
there's a physical interaction between the electron and that cylinder.
That's right.
Okay, so it takes all that spooky observer and measurement stuff out of the deal.
That's right.
And says this is nature acting on natural forces.
Yeah, there's no weirdness going. Well, there is weirdness. It's just, it's physical weirdness, not mystical weirdness.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
You know, I can put you in touch with some people if you want mystical weirdness.
No, I don't ever want to see what the bleep do you know.
Yeah, okay.
Ever again.
All right. Okay. Well, actually, yeah, you've been in touch with a lot more mystical weirdness than I have, so...
Well, you can spare yourself that one.
I'll try. Okay, well, I mean, we ended up with a flux quantization, which is actually really cool. And this is, I mean, this is one of these things that happens because of the analysis of experiment two. The interesting thing about experiment two is you end up having certain particular states where the cylinder can stop rotating. There are only a few of them that are actually possible.
There's discrete states, yeah. So they're going to be in positions A, B, or C. There's no 5, 30, 2. There's only 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
Weird.
And on top of that, if you do that analysis, you get that bit in there, and that's part of the reason why this thing doesn't work, is because you only end up with these discrete states. That's where that 2 pi n I was talking about earlier shows up. It's because you end up with discrete angular momentum level. So the angular momentum transfer from the electron to the cylinder, that transfer can only happen in integral multiples of Planck's constant.
Which sounds a lot like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but for some reason I'm thinking that's a property of gauge fields.
I mean, it's just like when you have a photodetector. A photodetector will pick up one little packet of energy at a time.
And they're saying that angular momentum comes in these packets.
Yeah, angular momentum also comes in these packets. That's what, say, the spin of an electron is, right? It's either h-bar over 2 up or h-bar over 2 down. Angular momentum comes in packets just like that. And that affects the energy. So if you get the energy from the Hamiltonian, you get little bits from that, plus you get a little bit from the flux. And it turns out, you know, you do everything, you say, okay, I can have these energy levels and these other things. It turns out that the total flux that's gone through that cylinder, because it can only go in these discrete states, the total flux has to be in a discrete state, because that's what's pushing it, is the magnetic flux, right? The magnetic flux going through the cylinder is what's pulling it, or is what's twisting it left or right, what's twisting it counterclockwise or clockwise.
So it doesn't matter, is it, now what is that dependent on? Is that dependent, that's not dependent on the speed of the electron, because that can be any speed, so it must have something to do with...
It's dependent on the electron charge, it's dependent on the speed of light, dependent on...
The radius of the cylinder?
No.
I would have thought that any of the fixed quantities would have been...
What they have written in the book doesn't have anything as far as the radius of the cylinder, so it's not quite like a black body thing, but it's like a black body thing. So it's that kind of quantization, the black body quantization, not the photon quantization, really. Okay. So it looks like just has Planck's constant, the speed of light, and the charge of whatever it is. For an electron, that charge would just be E, the charge of the electron. Where you usually hear about flux quantization is in superconductors. In that case, the charge is 2E because...
The Cooper pairs.
Because they're Cooper pairs, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice example they brought up in here. There's the they talked about the... I think the electrons moving around the outside to somehow... I guess they somehow... The flow of electrons on the surface of a superconductor somehow cancels the flow inside?
Yeah.
Okay, so then you get the, what is that, the Meissner effect?
Yes, you do. I don't, were they talking about that in this?
No.
Okay, yeah, yes, they do. I didn't remember that from this, but so I was getting really confused.
I've read this chapter 3 times, damn it. I don't remember that. All right, so magneto resistance.
Magneto resistance is just a application here. It's very interesting. This is a kind of magneto resistance that shows up because of flux quantization. It's actually the experimental proof that you have the flux quantization, and therefore you have this gauge dependence on the wave function.
Yeah.
And in this particular kind of magneto resistance, you know, they just have a gold loop. Well, they showed a gold loop. It's 1 micron size, about 1 micron in diameter, so it's pretty big. But they still were able to see oscillations on the order of 0.1% in the resistance.
But you've got to put a magnetic field through the middle of this thing, right, in order to get that quantization?
That's right.
How the heck did they target a magnetic field with that specificity?
They just need a magnetic field through it. They don't need a magnetic field directed at it.
Oh, I see. The magnetic field that it creates because of its fixed size.
No, you just put it in a uniform magnetic field.
Oh, I see. I thought it had to be contained, like, inside the circular ring.
It's the magnetic field inside of it. Doesn't care what's outside of
it. I see.
So it's the flux through the ring. There can be flux
in
a larger ring, but it won't affect what's in the smaller ring.
I thought it was nice of them to actually show a photograph of this, you know, 820 nanometer ring of gold and the lovely little sine wave pattern.
Well, yeah, that would be one of the few things that would, I think, improve this book, is that if it were possible to have an experimental section at the end of each chapter to show you what has actually happened. I mean, I am an experimental physicist, so to me that really brings it home, that this really is real. Show me a little bit of data, and you show me something nice like that, all sorts of good things come out of it.
Yeah.
And that's when they start talking about non-abelian phases.
Yeah, I remember coming across this and thinking, wait, was this supposed to be an undergraduate book? Because I was like, I didn't even come across that term until I was pretty deep in looking into particle physics and, you know, stuff way over my head. Non-abelian gauge theory. Great. Everybody loves that.
Doesn't seem to be an important part of the chapter or the book, to be honest. I think it's just thrown in there. I mean, it does start talking about Yang-Mills theory, and all of a sudden you have multiple wave functions for your wave function. Your wave function is a vector of indeterminate size. Actually, it has a size. I wrote down indeterminate size because I have some books from around the time this was showing up. So I used to go to used bookstores a lot and just buy random physics books.
Me too. It's a lot cheaper to learn off the old stuff, but it doesn't necessarily keep you up to date on everything.
Well, instead of the gauge, you end up with a unitary matrix. And unitary just has some meaning, basically, that I think it's trace is one.
Yeah, they mentioned that.
I think they have some other properties, but I haven't done that sort of matrix algebra for a very long time. Complex matrix algebra, it's been a little while. They just modify how you get the vector and scalar potentials from this unitary matrix instead of just a simple function, and it's ugly. It's not that ugly, but it's kind of ugly. But it's ugly.
They bring in Hermitian matrices in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't come across that term until I was looking into, a German physicist who was looking for a unified field theory. What does that mean? What is a Hermitian matrix?
Hermitian?
Yeah, Hermitian.
I don't remember. I think it has something to do with the complex conjugates when you take the transpose. It's been a very long time since I had to deal with
this. Okay. So, but the general point here is that the gauge function can take on this different series of variables?
The gauge function can be produced this way through this matrix instead. So you instead of having a gauge function, you have a gauge matrix because you have a vector wave function. That requires the gauge to be a matrix rather than a simple function.
It's a 2x2 matrix in that case?
It's a 2x2 matrix for the electroweak forces, 3x3 for strong forces.
And this is, in the case we've been looking at, is just a 1x1, right?
It's just a scalar function. It's 1x1. So we have just one wave function. We have a 1x1 matrix, which is just basically a scalar. There's nothing weird happens with it. Some mathematicians are angry at me now. You have two elements in your wave function, then you need a 2x2 matrix.
Hmm.
No, it's not two elements in your wave function. I guess it's two wave functions in your wave function. So I'm not really sure what the difference between these interior wave functions and the full state vector are. That's not really explained very well in this because it's like a page and a half at the end of the chapter.
Not even that. I mean, overall, but it doesn't start getting into like the Hermitian to matrices, and the talk. He doesn't start really talking about non-abelian gauge fields and non-commutative algebra until the last paragraph, and just kind of brushes it off. Like, thanks.
Non-commutative algebra isn't that weird. It's just you start adding on a lot of these concepts at once, and they take on a lot of meaning really, really quickly. Anyway, well, that's all I've got. Do you have anything else?
Yeah. When I did a little Wikipedia looking at this, and this troubled me. There's a line here that says, however, Vaidman has challenged this interpretation, the interpretation of the Aharonov-Bohm effect, by showing that the Aharonov-Bohm effect can be explained without the use of potentials so long as one gives a full quantum mechanical treatment to the source charges that produce the electromagnetic field. According to this view, the potential in quantum mechanics is just as physical or non-physical as it was classically. What I read from that is that very much like something that I came across recently refuting vacuum energy for the Casimir effect interpretation, you can look at these kind of experiments and get the same results without taking these gauge functions as a physical thing like we've been doing throughout our conversation, which is disturbing. I mean, if this is true, if you can explain the Aharonov-Bohm effect using pure quantum treatment of the quantum mechanical treatment of these charges and their fields, then what are we really, you know, what's our real interpretation then? I mean, can we somehow eliminate everything that we've just talked about?
Well, I don't think you eliminate it.
It sounds like
you,
there's a different way to explain it entirely.
You still end up destroying that interference pattern. So right now we haven't gotten into anything that requires a change in interpretation. Now, there might be some implications for those interpretations that we'll get to in Chapter 9. But I don't know what they are off the top of my head. Who was the guy who did this?
Vaidman, it says. V-A-I-D-M-A-N. And there's a link to, I guess, a paper down here. So
if Dr. Vaidman wants to give us a call, we'll be happy to interview him as a supplement.
Sounds good.
Okay.
You can call him since you're the doctor.
Well, no, he has to get in touch with us because
people will just be clamoring.
We have absolutely no need to be impartial in this because it's our podcast, right?
That's right.
Okay.
So eat it.
If he thinks it's an important enough podcast to give us a call, we'll give him time. I think that's all I've got, and you don't have anything more?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Then I think I better go call my wife.
That sounds like a good plan.
All right. See you later.
Thanks, Jim.